Ladies and gentlemen, welcome wrestling fans worldwide to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of the largest and oldest wrestling family on the planet.
Listen to what I'm saying. That's right. Bring that camera in here a little bit closer.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the stud is here.
All right, here we go, everybody. Welcome in. It's David Summers hosting another Studcast with the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller. It's the story of wrestling in America as told by the stud, whose family started the profession over 100 years ago. So now let's step back into the ring and back into time as we get wall to wall and treetop tall with the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller, in the Great Smoky Mountains of Tennessee. Hey, Ron, I think you've done it again. Your last Studcast about the 1920 Gold Dust Trio, explaining when wrestling went from real to what it is today, was another record setter. So you're also adding to your reputation, not just as a professional wrestling wrestler, but a professional wrestling historian. So, wow, there you go.
Yeah, well, man, nothing wrong with that, I guess. You know, so I have to admit, you know, more than 6 years ago when I did this first Studcast, I never saw any of this coming, man. So since I started doing these hidden history lessons, which is about the last couple of months, we've been doing this new segment for each one of these openings, and they seem to have brought on more new fans than ever. So the Gold Dust Trio was and always will be a unique time and a unique partnership in pro wrestling history, man. The strange deal, and we're going to have a little to talk about them today.
You know, their story is truly amazing, that things could change that much in pro wrestling in less than 10 years between 1920 and 1928, over 100 years ago.
You know, they laid the foundation, man, for all that was to come, good or bad, in the future.
All right, speaking of foundation in the future, the title for this one, this Studcast, is kind of unusual. The title is Roy's World and Stomper's Sit-Ups. That Roy's World part of your title has to be talking about the foundation and future of really your entire family.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, in fact, the photo from this Studcast is a classic in itself. From, I think, possibly, I don't know the time frame exactly, but I think this photo and this one is from basically 1940s. I don't know exactly what year, but it has my grandfather who's sitting on the left in the photo. And in the next to him is the world champion, Ed Strangler Lewis of the Gold Dust Trio. And on the other side of Ed Strangler Lewis is my grandfather's business partner, Nick Gulas. So we've got a great photo for this one. The fans will have an opportunity to see what Roy looks like. They'll also be able to see what Ed Strangler Lewis looks like. I think I was really happy to find this photo. And that's basically where we're going to start today, Dave, with my grandfather, Roy. And he was just that, the foundation and future for the largest wrestling family in the history of this sport. So today we're going to begin the journey to find out how a half American Indian became such a big part of what happened in this sport from the 1920s for the next 50 years into the 1970s. So my grandfather and I, we had many long conversations, some as he drove just the two of us to Memphis on many Mondays each summer when Rob and I went to spend most of the summer with my granddad and grandmother up in Tennessee. And it was about the only time we spent with him. My grandmother and my great-grandmother. She was still alive at this point, back in the day. And they lived in a little small town named Yorkville. He had a big dairy. And Yorkville's on the western side of Tennessee. It was only about 100 miles from Memphis. And all of the ride from his house to Memphis was on two-lane roads. And we were always going at about 100 miles an hour, sometimes more. And it was a time frame was between 1955 and 1958. And obviously, there was very few interstate highways back in those days. And very few state highway patrol officers, too. So sometimes, you know, we would get behind a slow-moving car, and he'd be having a little trouble passing him. And he would just reach down on the floorboard, and he had this little blue flashing police light. He'd sit it up on his dash, and he'd flip it on, and the car head would see the light behind him, and they'd pull over, and we would go flying past. I mean, Roy had his own way of doing things. And so to an 8-year and 10-year-old boy, you know, it's quite a high spot, man, as they say in the business, to have cars just pulling over to let him pass.
Oh, no doubt. It had to have made him a much larger-than-life figure in your mind's eye. Yeah, so your grandfather sounded like a real trip, literally, especially when he would get pulled over by the police and flash those special badges from governors and of many southern states, by the way, and always got released without a ticket. Not many grandfathers had that kind of pull.
You can say that again. You know, on all those car trips, we talked about wrestling, man, going and coming home. And off the top of my head, this is what I remember of his explaining what it was like when I first asked him how he started in professional wrestling at 22 years old in 1924. So that's basically where we're going to begin today. And it was in one of the two territories in the state of Ohio. It was in the one that he worked in, which was in Columbus, Ohio. And the other one was located in Toledo. It was the first time I ever heard in these conversations of the Goldust Trio. So as I explained last week, the Goldust Trio between 1920 and 1928, they spread professional wrestling all over North America. And they could only do that with the help, obviously, of hundreds of men, most of which weren't wrestlers, but people that were interested in the sport that saw basically a future in it. So I remember Roy said the Goldust Trio had something to do with him and what he had learned back then and that in those days. So I know he had a great relationship with Ed Strangler Lewis, the world champion at that time, because he had an office in his home in Yorkville at the dairy, and he had a lot of pictures of him and Ed Strangler Lewis on the office walls. And I also know that Roy was one of the charter members of the National Wrestling Alliance, the NWA. It was formed in 1948, happened to be the year I was born in. And Lou Thesz was the first NWA world champion, and Lou Thesz was trained and managed by Ed Strangler Lewis. So, you know, people will be able to see this picture associated with the show itself, and I think it'll be interesting for them to get an idea of what Roy looked like and what Ed Strangler Lewis looked like. So he told me when he started in 1924 that he only weighed 165 pounds. And they wouldn't let him use his name alone, you know. So to show the influence of the Goldust Trio, they were already adding nicknames to wrestlers' real names by 1924. So they had been basically in business about 4 years when Roy showed up in Ohio. They were kind of handling, that was one of their territories.
Wow.
So because they wouldn't let him use his real name, they let him use part of it, but they called him the Canadian Wildcat, Roy Welch.
Wow, just think about it. At only 22 years of age, he had left the panhandle area of Texas after being trained by the original Dutch Mantel, traveled more than 1,000 miles, and started wrestling out of Columbus, Ohio, as the Canadian Wildcat Roy Welch. How about that?
I tell you, man, it's, you know, that's all true. And when he left, my grandmother, She was pregnant with my father, and he didn't know what to expect when he got to Ohio. He had never been a professional wrestler before, and he didn't have any idea what to expect, or even if he was going to be able to last in the profession. Was he going to be able to make it or not? So he sent her, once he left the Panhandle, to live with her family in New Mexico. And boy, she was about as tough as Roy was. I mean, she worked on the farm next to where they lived in New Mexico, and she plowed behind a mule every day, all day long.
Wait, I don't think I heard correctly what you just said. Did you your grandmother plowed with a mule while she was pregnant? I don't think that is certainly not a modern day woman.
No, I'm certainly not. God. That's exactly what I said, man. He said he thought it was because of where that state was located. The reason that you would use that name of a Canadian wildcat, obviously only the Great Lakes separate Ohio from Canada. And it wouldn't have made much sense, obviously, to use a name that, that had to do with an American Indian because, you know, they were more than 1,000 miles away from that part of the country. So I asked how he got interested in the promotion and the ownership part of the business. And he told me both territories were extremely successful, and it didn't take him long to realize that the promoters and owners made a lot more money than the wrestlers did. And they didn't have to take a single bump, I think is the way he put it, or do a hard way to get the money, right? So it was a lot easier, and they made a lot more. So I'm pretty sure he had probably, within his first couple of years in the ring, decided to be not just a wrestler, but eventually the owner of a company in the future. And I'm also sure he was paying close attention to everything that was happening around him in those years from 1924 to about 1930, and learning how it all worked, man. And he was learning from the best, the trio. And he said in his last year there in 1929, the beginning of the Great Depression, he was brought into the office. And they used that year, that he spent a year in the office as well as wrestling. And that's the year he really learned the business from the inside out. So it was in that year, 1929, that he felt assured things were going to work out, you know, for him in the future as a wrestler. And he finally sent for my grandfather and my father, who had been born at this point, he's about 5 years old, to come to Ohio. So my father, at 5 years old, Roy had never seen him. That's pretty crazy, right?
Wow. As
a child, and yeah, you don't see him for the first 5 years of his life and then 5 years of your life.
Wow. So their first contact, turning into a real tough story here. 5 years he spent without seeing his wife, and the first time he was ever going to see his son.
Yeah, it sounds crazy, man. But what was coming in the years ahead for everybody in America was going to be like that and worse. I mean, so Roy was going to be leaving Ohio in 1930, and wrestling along with all the sports and most everything else was dying in the early years of the Great Depression. Roy had learned his craft and the business side of it as well, and he realized going forward that he wanted to be a wrestler. He knew that, you know, but, he was going to have to survive the hard times that were going to be trying to create a territory during the Great Depression, man. That was a big challenge, I guess is a good word for it. So in the next studcast, we're going to follow him, and several other Ohio wrestlers are going to go with him. Once he leaves and goes to start the business in Tennessee, and I think they realized that Roy had a head on his shoulders that was a little different than most wrestlers, and he was going to be more than just a wrestler. And they were willing to follow him, and they went south, so they left Ohio and went south into the great state of Tennessee. And so before, Dave, I think, we're going to be getting somewhere near here break time, I want to tell a story that my father told me many years ago about something that happened to him as a little boy in Ohio before Roy took him and my grandmother into Tennessee. And it kind of says a lot about Roy's personality and what kind of a mind he had.
Wow. I would never turn down an opportunity to hear one of your stories, much less one about your grandfather, that comes in such hard times as the Great Depression. Wow.
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously it was about as bad as things ever got in this country. So Dad told me this story, and he said once he was about 5 years old, and he said he used to go play with the kids down the street, and he said there was a bully there that was probably 10 years old, and he was only five, and he said he always wore a ball cap, and Dad had very curly hair all his life, but I'm sure it was very curly and unruly probably back in those days. It didn't probably have many barbers around, you know, he said that he would go down there to play with these kids, and the bully would get on him, and he would start talking to him. Then he would push him around and shove him, and then eventually he would knock his hat off, his little baseball hat off, and he would grab Dad handfuls of Dad's little curly hair, and he would just start jerking his hair, And Dad ended up, you know, he's 5 years old, and this kid is 10 years old. And, you know, so Dad he wasn't big enough, I'm sure, to defend himself, and didn't know really how to handle it. So he said, you know, one day him and Roy was alone, and I talked to my dad, and he said, I asked him, he said, I'm having a problem with this kid down the street. And Roy said, what's the story? And he said, I told him that he was kind of bullying me and jerking my hair. And, you know, he said, I explained to him as best I could what he was doing. Mm-hmm. And he said, okay. He said he took about 2 minutes and kind of went, okay, all right, let's take care of that. And so Roy so Dad said he had no idea what he was going to do. So he said he went in and he got some clippers and he clipped all of Dad's hair off. Dad basically cut his hair so short he didn't have any hair left. And he told him, he said he put the little baseball cap on his head, and he told him, he said, now I want you to go back down there. And he says, and when he starts this time, he says, let him just do everything you've been doing, just do what you've been doing. And then when he says he reaches up and he snatches that hat off and he reaches for that hair, he goes, I want you to get a double handful of his. And he said, I want you to start jerking his hair out. He said, I want you to just slam his face in the dirt. And he told him all these things. So my dad went down the street, and you know, sure enough, they had the same deal. The boy got this, doing the same thing to him, and he knocked that hat off, and he reached up there to grab that hair, and there was no hair there to be grabbed. And Dad got a double handful of his hair, and Dad said, "You know," he said, "I never had a problem with that kid ever after that." That was a pretty good way to handle it. Roy had a pretty good mind about how to handle certain situations. That seemed to work out pretty good for him.
Yeah, that's sort of going by the do unto others if they do it to you. Way of thinking. I really don't think your family thought like most families did. Oh, son, you can't hit him back. No, that was not the case. And this was a tough time that you're talking about. Also, your grandfather was definitely a real trip. All right, before we go to our break, let's move to the card that you're going to be talking about after the break. Mobile, Alabama. This is going to be a big one. And I think the date is going to be Tuesday, March 18th, 1980. Lay it out for us, stud.
All right. So I'm going to call this a transitional card. I mean, you know, we'd have been having these cards a long series of them where same guys are wrestling each other. They're just changing the matches when the rules or whatever You know, it's a 2 out of 3 fall match, or it becomes a no DQ match. But the cards kind of were remaining same. So you're going to be able to tell by this card that it's a kind of a totally different setup here. And a lot of things are going to change as far as the way these cards had been booked for a while. So in the first match, going to be Charlie Cook, and he was going to be taking on the fabulous Don Fargo, who called himself the Fabulous Fargo. And he was pretty fabulous, to be honest with you. Eddie Boulder was going to be meeting Big Bill Dromo. Joe LeDuc was going to be wrestling against Jimmy Golden, first time ever. In a challenge match, Tony Charles was going to be facing Dr. Bill Irwin, the new guy that liked to have his lasso hooked around people's throats. And for the Southeastern tag belts, Rob and I, we were the champions. We're going to be defending against a brand new commendation, Norvell Austin and Randy Rose. And then the main event was going to be for the Southeastern Championship. The Mongolian Stomper, who was managed by Don Carson, was going to be defending against the Georgia Jawjacker. And it was going to be in a special 2 out of 3 fall match, which very rarely did you ever have those for a championship.
Yeah, no doubt. All right, so really a great card with only one returning match from the week before. Two title matches, and one of those, a rare best 2 out of 3 falls, and 4 openers that were all changed around from what the cards had been. That's what we've got ahead of us when we come back after the break as this Studcast continues. Stay with us right here. All right, Studcast fans, on the break, there's big news if you're in Southeast Alabama, Southwest Georgia, or the Panhandle of Florida. If you've always wanted to meet the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller, you can see the Stud this coming Saturday night in the Ozark Civic Center. Stud, tell us what's happening.
Yeah, man, I'm taking a little trip south, man. That's kind of be like being a wrestler again, man. I'm not taking my bag with me, but I'm going to bring some souvenirs for fans. You know, so it's going to be it's great. I love doing this. I don't get to do as much of it as I'd like to. But, I'm coming down to Ozark, Alabama. Going to be in the Ozark Civic Center. And I'm not going to be the only one of the old timers from Southeastern Continental days. Wendell Cooley's going to be there. So is Scott Armstrong. So we're going to have a little bit of the old days in this particular wrestling event. And really looking forward to it. And like you said, basically, I invite people from that part of the country, come say hello. I'm going to have some 8x10 photographs with me. I'm going to bring my book. I've got some copies of Brutus. I'm going to have some Southeastern t-shirts for $10, Dave. I mean, you can't beat a deal like that. And Wow, just looking forward to seeing some of those fans from down in that part of the country. And I don't usually do these things, but this one I think is going to be kind of special. I may end up managing one of their boys in this down in that part of the country, one of the new guys. So I'm kind of looking forward to it, and I hope everybody get a chance, come by, say hello.
All right, Ron, you're not going to be directly involved in a match, are you?
I don't know, man. I'm thinking about just going down to the ring with this dude. I hope I don't hurt anybody if something happens.
Yeah. Nobody needs that. I'm thinking about Don Carson as a manager. That's what I'm thinking about. And you don't. Yeah. All right. Look, if I show up and I want to buy one of your books, the Brutus novel, which I really think is awesome, could I get you to autograph it personally for me while you're there?
Absolutely. For darn sure, man. You know, and then, I'm even going to take pictures. I'll take pictures with the fans down there, too.
Oh, cool. Like, so if I got my iPhone with me, always, everywhere. It's like a gun. I take it everywhere. So if I bring my phone, I can get a selfie with the Stud.
Yes, sir.
Cool deal.
I'll even do it with you, Dave.
Oh, you would? You would actually recognize me in a crowd? That's awesome. All right, that sounds like fun. This coming Saturday night, Ozark Civic Center, you guys got to check it out. An appearance from the Tennessee Stud. What's going to happen? He's not revealing at this point, but we'll find out Saturday night in Ozark, Alabama. All right, here we go. Second half of this studcast. This is episode number 342. Can you believe that? 342 of these. This one is called Roy's World Stompers Sit-Ups, which we're fixing to hear about Stompers Sit-Ups, whatever's going on with that. All right, so since you covered it before the break, we know what was going to be coming to Mobile, Alabama on Tuesday, March 18th, 1980. All right, so what was coming on the TV show 4 days later to set up this big night of wrestling?
Well, this one, man, is going to be a very different, Dave, as you could kind of tell from listening to the card. So it opened up with Don Carson and Charlie Platt. This TV is different because the card is kind of totally different from what we've been doing. And so this TV opens up with Don Carson and Charlie Platt in a totally different studio than the normal studio. And it had the Mongolian Stomper down on his back and starting to do sit-ups. And there was a person there counting out loud as each one that he did. And a second person that was keeping a tally of the number. So Charlie announced to the TV audience kind of what was happening here, that Don Carson's Mongolian Stomper was going to try and set a new world record for the number of sit-ups that could be done in 60 minutes. And that he had just begun because the program had just started. And he wasn't going to stop until the end of the TV show. 1 hour, 60 minutes later. So then Charlie observed, they obviously had a camera in here. He says, we're going to have a camera here. It's going to be recording this. And from time to time during this TV show, we'll be coming back into this studio. It'll update everybody on the... this basically tremendous test of strength and stamina. I mean, wow, what the heck is this all about, basically?
Yeah, I think I have a vague remembrance of this. This was a big deal back in the day. So he was he going for a world record or just proving a point? What was this about?
Oh, he was going for a world record. The world record was 2,201 sit-ups.
Right. Okay.
In an hour's time. And he was going to trying to break the world record. Yeah, man, he was really trying to break a world record. And by golly, had a darn good chance of doing it, man. I mean, he wow. was a phenomenal athlete. So Charlie and Carson, following this little introduction, they went to the regular set. And Charlie invited Carson to join him later in what was going to be called the sit-up studio. During the course of the day. So for today's personality profile, he said, why don't you join me back there in the sit-up studio? And he said, because I want to find out why. Why is this happening, So Carson returned, he left, and he went back into the sit-up studio, and Charlie went on with the show. So Charlie ran down the TV card for the show, and then he invited me and Rob to come to the set. And we watched a recorded match from Mobile 4 days earlier. And we were like you, Dave, we were blown away. We didn't really have an idea that the Stomper was really going to try for this world record. So we were asking Charlie questions about it. Now, what the heck is this all about? And we even asked, hey, they got a camera back there. You just said you got a camera back there. Can we break away now and see what the heck's going on back there right now? So Charlie says, yeah, we're just getting started here, but sure. So obviously he had him take the camera. They had a camera in that studio. And obviously he said, okay. So right away they bounced the camera right into there. They got the shot of Stomper's doing the sit-ups, and then the guy that was the tally man, he held up a big piece of paper in front of the camera. They were set and prepared for this, and it had 4 minutes and 136 sit-ups. He'd been doing it for 4 minutes, had 136.
Wow.
And the Stomper was cranking them out behind him there, man, and the studio crowd responded to it, man. They were like, wow, what the heck? This is pretty crazy, man. And this was going to be an interesting thing during the entire show. So Rob and I watched this championship tag match, our championship tag match against Jimmy Golden and the Big C from the Tuesday night before. And it quickly became apparent the Big C kept continually trying to load his glove. I mean, one time after another, until we finally just went to the dressing room on purpose, you know, and we got ourselves counted out. We wanted that. I said, let's leave here, Rob. Let them count us out. We can't lose the belts on a count out. So let's just go to the dressing room. If you're going to try to load his glove and hit us with it, why not just leave? So we did. And then Golden and the Big C, they got their hands raised in the victory. And wow, they were all smiles about it. And the fans hated it. Wow, they got so much heat, then it kind of registered with them that, hey, we can't win the belts on a count out. So it turned on them in a way. So then the Mobile crowd, they realized that they weren't going to get the belts, they went crazy, hey, geez, they threw the referee out of the ring. I mean, it was like, so the crowd went crazy too. They loved it. They got to cheering and laughing about it. So we told Charlie, that we had decided after this not to defend against these two guys again, because, Carson likely is going to try to load his glove all the time. And until he gets serious about getting rid of the black glove or not making a point of trying to use it, we don't have to wrestle then. So we also told him, he said we had talked to Don Curtis, and we told him what our decision was, we'd like to just pick our own opponents. We don't want to wrestle Carson and Jimmy Golden because Carson's going to try to hit somebody with his glove and win the belts in that way. Don Curtis said, sure, of course, I think that's a great idea. I'm going to allow you to pick your opponents.
You get to pick your opponents. Wow. All right. Who did you pick?
Well, we picked the wrestlers that's going to be in this first match, and that was Randy Rose and Norvell Austin. And, odd combination, but, they'd never wrestled together before. So this was going to cause a great deal of dissension between the heels, all of them, because they were wanting a chance, all of those guys, to win a championship belt, and especially the tag team belts. And so you couldn't tell that by looking at these guys, the Rose and Austin, though, in their first TV match. Rob and I was expecting to see a couple guys that fumbled around and fell on each other and whatever. And wow, they were on the same page. I mean, it was ridiculous. So we let Charlie and the fans know that we recognize it. And Charlie says, geez, Ron, they look like a great team. So it was obvious they made a good team, and it didn't take long in finishing off their opponent. And when they did, Norvell shot his guy into the ropes, and he hit him with a big diving headbutt. And Rose shot his guy on the other side of the ring and hit him with a clothesline. So they had a big win. And so before we left the set, we asked Charlie to show us again and the fans what was happening in the sit-up studio. Because, let's get the present count, Charlie. Let's see what's going on back there. So when they popped on to back there into the sit-up studio, there was the tally guy. He already had the paper ready. He had counted it up. He was ready for us. It had 14 minutes. At this point, it was 14 minutes into the show. He had done 470 sit-ups. And Stomper was beginning at this point to show some drops of sweat. He's 14 minutes in. Wow. Anybody would be sweating big time. And he had a few drops of sweat going. And the studio audience, they buzzed like bees, man, talking about this. What the heck? Wow, look at this. This is crazy.
Yeah, that's a great idea. I mean, for this to be happening, the duration of the show, even if the Stomper was a heel, it certainly didn't hurt to show what incredible shape you guys were in. All right, so who was in the second segment of the show as the sit-ups continue?
Well, Tony Charles was at the set with Charlie, and they watched the video of Tony Charles beating Randy Rose right in the middle of the ring. He'd had this 3 or 4 week deal with Randy Rose. And this one, if he won this one, he got the keeper's belt, and he had never had to wrestle Randy Rose again if he didn't want to. So he kept his United, he won, he kept his belt, and he also eliminated Randy Rose from any future shots at the title. So then Charlie told him another reason he invited him out there. He said, you're going to be facing the guy. He says, he says to Tony, he goes, a few of us have kind of named this guy. We call him the cowboy, right? Because he goes, he has this lasso that he brings with him to the ring every night. And when he gets a win, he likes to tie his opponents up, you know. And so Tony kind of chuckled at it a little bit. But you could tell, man, Tony had watched this young star. And as an old pro, he knew you best not underestimate any opponent. Didn't make any difference how young he was. So, you know, Tony was an old master at the sport, man. So Dr. Bill was in the next match, and he was moving up the card fast, and he was getting a shot at Tony Charles, man, and he'd only been there 3 weeks. And I think that made Dr. Bill a little bit more arrogant than he already was. So when he entered the ring with his lasso, he just started twirling it around his head, and he's yelling at Tony. He says, and you could hear what he's screaming. He said, get ready to be hogtied, old man.
Wow.
Not a good thing to say to Tony Charles.
Yeah. Right?
So back in the dressing room, Rob and I, we could see the look on Tony Charles' face when he heard that, right? Sitting there with Charlie. And so Dr. Bill didn't know what he was getting into, man. I mean, you know, so, but it didn't stop him. And he'd already tied up Roy Lee Welch in his first win in the first week, and Eddie Boulder in the second week. And, you know, I guess he assumed that Tony Charles was just going to be his next to conquer.
Line them up, boys. I was going to ask about the profile and who was on it, but I'm curious, did anybody ask for an update on the sit-up challenge by now? I'm sure they did.
Oh, yeah. Everybody in the building was interested in it, you know. So before Charlie went to the break, mm-hmm. he asked the director to show everybody what was happening in the other studio. So the camera got a shot of Stomper again, and he was cranking out the sit-ups, man. He had the same pace. It was like, wow, he was one after another. I mean, no slowing down. And so we got the present numbers, and they held up the paper again. This time it was 36 minutes into the show, and he had done 1,200 sit-ups, 36 minutes. And so the Stomper was sweating big time by this time, man. But there was no change in his pace. You watched it for just a second, and you could see this son of a gun has not slowed down a bit in the number that he's cranking out. So the in-studio cameras, they caught the studio audience reaction, and they were buzzing even more than me and Rob and the others of us watching what was going on. And obviously, this was becoming a big thing. This attempt was a legit attempt for the world record.
Oh, no doubt. I mean, this really has everybody buzzing, including me, Stud. I missed this. I think I missed the show, but I know I have seen some bits of this along the way. 44 years ago, I can't imagine doing, I can't, me personally, 200 sit-ups. I don't, much less 1,200 sit-ups. So anyway, he was over halfway through the show with 24 more minutes to go. So I think earlier Charlie mentioned something to Don Carson at the beginning of the show about being on the profile. All right. So how was that done? And with the whole sit-up thing going on too?
Yeah, you know, this was, like I said, this show was pretty much totally different than most of the shows we had done. So Charlie joined Carson. Carson was in the sit-up studio, and Charlie went into the sit-up studio. They did the profile. Instead of being on a normal set, they did it in that studio there. And and the entire time they were on the screen, Stomper's behind him, grinding away, man. He is going for the record. And Carson had a towel. When Charlie went in there, Carson had a towel, and he was wiping the Stomper's sweat from his face. But, you know, he was doing his best not to get in the Stomper's way. You could tell he had a rhythm going. And, you know, it was pretty amazing stuff here. So Charlie asked, you know, what's this all about? You know, you know, he said, did this have anything to do with the fact that your Stomper here is going to be wrestling against the Georgia Jawjacker defending his belt in a 2-out-of-3-fall championship match? So Carson basically, as Carson always did, kind of took it from there, you know. And he was ready for this, you know. He had time to think about what he wanted to say, and you could almost see it when he took over. And he began by saying, first thing he said is, you know, my Mongolian Stomper, he should not even be in the ring with somebody called the Georgia Jawjacker. He said, everybody knows my Stomper beat Bob Armstrong 3 months ago in a loser leave match on December 19, 1979. He had the dates. And then Charlie kind of interrupted him. And then, you know, he said, wait. He said, he beat the great Mephisto's Mongolian Stomper. Mephisto was the managing him. You weren't his manager at that time on that night. So that just made Don mad. So he just stopped Charlie flat, and he said, you know, and then he asked Charlie, he said, well, what the difference? He said, what difference, if any, does that make in the fact that the Stomper won the loser leaves match? And that he said, Charlie Platt, he goes, the fans here are not aware that there was another Southeastern company years before there, and that the Southeastern wrestling there, was not like the Gulf Coast wrestling, but during that time frame in 1976 and 1977, when you had the old Gulf Coast wrestling, I was in Tennessee with the other Southeastern wrestling, and I was managing the Mongolian Stomper way back, a long time ago. So he continued asking, you know, he said, you know, regardless of who he was managing, he said to Charlie, he said, he didn't lose in that loser leave match to Bob Armstrong 3 months ago, but he said, Charlie, I'm going to give him a chance. Bob Armstrong is going to should have left immediately when he lost that match 3 months ago. And, you know, he said, and did he leave immediately like he was supposed to, Charlie? Well, Charlie didn't even get a chance to answer him. Carson just went on. He asked him then, he says, you know, when a wrestler loses a loser leave match, how long are they supposed to stay gone, Charlie Platt? And again, he didn't allow him to answer, and he blurted out, 1 full year, Charlie Platt, and you know that. And so then he pushed on, man. He said, do you, Charlie Platt, or anybody else with Southeastern Wrestling, believe that Georgia Jawjacker is not Bob Armstrong? So Charlie didn't answer that one then. So Carson just continued on. He said, we all know who this Jawjacker is. And he says, and you see right in front of you, in front of me right now, in the process, right down there on the floor, there's a guy breaking the world record. The baddest human being on the planet, my Mongolian Stomper, is about to break a world record. And heck yes, he's doing it to get ready for this 2-out-of-3-falls match for the championship. So he says, then he just, he's cranked, and Charlie didn't get hardly a word in after Don got started. And he basically ended up saying he's not only going to beat Armstrong again in this upcoming 2-out-of-3-falls match, but he's going to pull that silly mask off his face, and he's going to show everyone that the so-called Georgia Jawjacker is nothing but a weed whacker. Named Armstrong. And he said, and he's going to be gone from here forever, Charlie Platt, because once he loses that and they find out it's Armstrong under the mask, he's gone for good. So and then he just, and then Don said, you can leave now. go back to your little set over there. And he says, because me and my stomper are going to make history here.
Wow. Now, that is what a personality profile is. Don Carson on fire. So I feel a little sorry for Charlie after that one. So, all right, how about the next segment? Set that up for us.
Well, Jimmy Golden joined Charlie at the set, and he was already upset with him in the Big C, not getting another title shot because of the way that the Big C had tried to load his glove all match long. And he was even more upset with being invited out there because he wasn't going to watch anything to do with him. He was going to watch a match between Joe LeDuc and Don Fargo, in which Joe LeDuc literally flattened Fargo. Joe LeDuc was a monster at that time. And so Jimmy's like, he was already very upset, and he was having a difficult time not showing it.
All right, Golden seemed, Jimmy seemed a little bit upset as well. So how about, who was in the next TV match after Golden watched the video?
Well, that was Joe LeDuc, you know. And now there's Jimmy sitting there, man. And the studio audience, they loved Joe. They were crazy about Joe. And so Golden had to sit there. What's he going to say during this match? And he had to watch him put the bear hug on his TV opponent and made him give up. And Rob and I were kind of looking at each other, and I kind of remember saying something about, do you think Jimmy's having a problem figuring that could be him next week in the next bear hug?
Jimmy was not having a good day, obviously. All right, how about the last TV segment of the day?
Well, the show ended, man, with another star, the Georgia Jawjacker. And wow, he was just over as just like LeDuc was. And he ended up putting his guy to sleep. And he left that studio bleachers rocking, man.
Wow. How about the sit-ups deal? World record try. How did it turn out?
Well, it ended in the last minute of the show. You know, it was a 60-minute trial. You know, you had 60 minutes. And so it started in the first minute of the show. And we ended up, Charlie went into the room, and he's there for the last 60 seconds. Mm-hmm. So the Mongolian Stomper, they ended the deal, the countdown, bang, there it was, the last sit-up. Then Tally Guy then had already had, he was right on top of it. And so he gave the tally. He said, Mongolian Stomper had done 2,025 sit-ups. The world record was 2,201. Wow. So he was basically less than 200 sit-ups short of the world record.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty interesting, TV. But I'm curious, how long did it take the guy to do the world record in 2,201 versus the Stomper did everything in an hour, right?
He did. The other guy did it in an hour, too.
Okay. All right.
There was a one-hour time limit to see who could do the most sit-ups in an hour.
Okay, I missed that. All right.
So,
but
So the guy beat him by just about, less than 200 sit-ups, man. I don't know what the other guy looked like, but that's a heck of a feat, man. I mean, the Stomper was a monster.
Oh, no doubt. And definitely in shape. I can't believe the Mongolian Stomper came that close to a world record. But thinking back on it and what his body looked like, I guess anybody can believe it if you can picture that. All right, so let's go to Mobile's Expo Hall the following Tuesday, March 18th, 1980. Set that up for us, Dud.
Well, Charlie Cook, he won his match over Don Fargo. Eddie Boulder beat Bill Dromo. Tony Charles and Dr. Bill Irwin wrestled to... I watched it, man. What a great match they had. This Irwin kid, man, he's really something for not being a wrestler any longer. He had been in the sport. They had a 30-minute time limit match. Tony couldn't beat him in the 30 minutes. And I was really, really blown away by that fact that, that kid could last 30 minutes with Tony Charles. Joe LeDuc won by disqualification. over Jimmy. Jimmy got disqualified. And then in the Southeastern Tag Championship match, Rob and I, since we were allowed by Don Curtis to pick our own opponents, our next opponents, we found that that was maybe not the right thing because it kind of opened the door for all kinds of guys to get involved in our tag matches. Guys, we're going to, we found out in this very first match that we that picked our opponents that we're going to end up with a ring full of guys. So each one of these guys, these heels over there, wanted to get a shot at the title, and they figured out, well, if we go down and get involved, they're going to pick us, right? So so we had Rose and Norvell Austin beat, and you know, about to win the match, and here comes Jimmy Golden flying into the ring, and he stomps me off of Rose. I had him covered for the pin. And then I got that got automatically Rose and Austin disqualified. And Golden grabbed the referee and just threw him over the top rope, threw him out of the ring. And so then that was just the beginning. So Rob and I came back into the ring. We threw Rose and Austin over the top rope. And we both started to put the boots to Jimmy Golden. And there comes the Big C with his black glove. And he wasn't even on this card. If you notice, the Big C, well, he comes down and he's not even on the card. He's, in fact, he's not got wrestling tights on. He's got his street clothes on. And he ends up hitting Robert with his glove and busts him open. And then Jimmy grabs me and he's about to hit me. And I ducked it and he hit Jimmy. And then I got on the Big C. And then here comes the doctor, the young kid, man. And he's got his lasso. And so he put his lasso around my neck while Golden and Big C were stomping Rob. And finally, Joe LeDuc came from out of nowhere, man, cleared the ring, man. And I guess, man, we'd made a mistake asking Don Curtis to let us pick our opponents.
Wow.
You know, I mean, it didn't turn out anything like we thought. So,
right.
So then in the last match, that was the best 2 out of 3 falls match, the Southeastern Championship between the champion Stomper, managed by Carson, and the Georgia Jawjacker. The Georgia Jawjacker won the first fall, and the Mongolian Stomper were in the second fall. And then the Stomper seemed to be blowing up in the third fall. And, you know, I watched the match, and I was thinking, wow, how's he handling this? Did that take all of those sit-ups maybe 4 days earlier in that TV studio, did that take something out of him? Because you could see he was really having a hard time. But they had gone probably 45 minutes in the first two falls. So Don Carson, at that point, he saw the Stomper was blowing up, and he just kept pulling him out of the ring,
Wow.
So the time limit end up running out. It went 60 minutes in this 2 out of 3 fall match. The time limit ran out. There was no winner. There was declared a draw.
Wow, that had to be a tremendous match. Both of those guys in tremendous shape, too. I don't think I ever saw a 2 out of 3 fall match end in a draw, but with those two in the ring, I would have loved to have seen that. So how about the attendance in those three major cities set that up for us, Stud?
Well, Montgomery was down only 200 fans from 4,100. It went down to just below 4,000 to 3,900. Big crowd, wow, for Montgomery, Alabama. Dothan went down only 100, from 4,200 down to 4,100. Over 4,000 in Dothan, and town as small as Dothan. Wow, what it is. Yeah. One best little wrestling city in America.
Oh, no doubt.
Dothan, Alabama. And Mobile went down 100 from 5,400 to 5,300. So the total for the three was 13,300. Still a lot of people. Not a lot of territories had three cities doing that kind of business in 1 week.
Yeah, and remind me, we're talking 1980. Remind me, what were ticket prices, roughly, if you can remember?
I think it were probably four for ringside, three for adult general admission, and $2.
$4 for ringside.
$4. I mean,
wow.
You know, and I could be a dollar off. It could be $5 and $4 and $3.
Yeah.
But I think it was not it was definitely not above $5 for a ringside seat.
Yeah, gotcha. I tell you, this has been another great one, Stud. It looks like we will have time again for another Learning Tree question. How about let's do that now? This one comes from Thomas Davis, New London, Connecticut. Thomas says, I have listened to all of your Ask the Stud question and answer shows. I think your last one, number 15, is the best so far. He says, my question is, how are you able to answer questions on so many different subjects that have to do with almost every aspect of the sport? And do you think you will ever run out of questions from the fans?
Wow. Well, that's a good question from you, Thomas. A couple of good questions from you. I guess I'll save for the end the answer of if I'm ever going to run out of questions from fans. Before I get to answering this, though, Dave, I need to tell a little story here about, and this is for Thomas here, about the city in which you live, Thomas. New London, Connecticut was the place that during World War II, they trained officers for the Merchant Marines. In fact, my father, when he went into World War II, he trained as an officer in the United States Marines in New London, Connecticut, right? And then this is crazy that I got somebody from New London, Connecticut. And that branch of the service, the Merchant Marines during the war, they maybe lost more men than any other form of fighters, because they were getting, all these ships were getting sunk, you know, and they were carrying bombs and tanks and weapons and ammunition back and forth from America to Europe. You know, it was a very, very dangerous job. And I got to tell a little story here. I can't help but do this because it brings this back to me. My dad told me this story, and it's about one of his trips across the Atlantic. And when he was first starting out as a Merchant Marine, he said they had bombs that back in those days they called blockbusters. I don't know if you've ever heard about these, Dave, but a blockbuster, they called it a blockbuster because when that bomb went off, it would destroy an entire city block.
Wow.
That's strong. That's strong. A bomb.
Yeah.
My dad told me it was one of his first crossings, and that all sailors were required to wear their life jackets at all times in case you got hit by a torpedo from a German submarine, you know, you might get blown off of the ship or whatever. So he said he was walking on the ship one day, and he noticed that there was an officer there that wasn't wearing a life jacket. So Dad often asked him, you know, he said, hey, what's the story here? You're not wearing a life jacket. And, the officer told him, he said, you know, son, he says, this ship is loaded with blockbuster bombs. And he says, wow. If we get hit, he said, you ain't going to need a life jacket, son. You're going to need a parachute.
Wow. God. You're going on a little trip.
So sorry for that diversion, Thomas. I'll get back to the subject here, but I always love that story. But your city's name, it kind of brought the story back to me. So as far as why I can answer so many questions about so many different subjects that have to do with, I think you said, every aspect of the sport, it's pretty simple, basically. I grew up in it, man, and I did just about all of the things that you did in wrestling, man, at one time or another, from the time I was little to the time I was a grown man and in the sport myself. I did them all at one time or another in my life. So I started, you know, as an example, at 7 or 8 years old, I would work in my dad's welding shop. He used to build bleachers and wrestling rings, and I would do whatever he needed me to do or wanted me to do. And then I watched doors at matches. you know, in the back of buildings when I was, you know, 8, 10 years old, you know, doors where people might try to come in the back door without paying or whatever. And then I guess I got older. I started setting up chairs for ringside seats and selling Cokes in the concession stands and sweeping out the buildings when the matches were over. And then as I got even bigger, I moved from the back of the building kind of toward the front of the building. Started setting up rings and selling tickets and sometimes in the front of the buildings. And so when I started driving, I started putting out these posters, advertising posters all over big cities in Memphis and in Atlanta and places like that. And all along, all this other time, besides all that, I was learning to wrestle, man. From that little backdoor gig to sneaking off in college and having my first real matches. You know, I was just totally engrossed in the business. And,
wow.
So my first territory, I started, you know, studying the TV show process, how all that worked, and the building of a great card. How do you put together a great card? And then figuring the great finishes, and then finally running the booking, being the booker of my own territory. You know, I worked with building management, TV station management. I learned to produce my own TV shows, and I dealt with production companies and politicians like Roy, you know, athletic commissions like Roy, and other owners around the world, all over the world. I knew all these wrestling promoters and all these guys, and so basically, Thomas, I've done it all, man, and I thank the good Lord I've been somewhat successful in the process of doing so. So, you know, thanks for your question there, Mr. Davis. But and then as far as running out of fans' questions, you know, I got to be honest with you, man. I love what I do, especially with the Ask the Stud programs and things like that. I hope that never happens, man. And the longer I do this, the more I realize how many extremely knowledgeable fans there are out there, man. And I hope that is never going to end.
That's a great answer, Ron. I think you left out nothing to explain what it takes to learn just about everything in a business. These studcasts have become legendary, and this one just joined the others. So where are we going to be riding next week?
Well, our hidden history lesson next week is going to take us further into Roy's world, man. We're going to follow him and his first wrestlers. He's going to have a small group of wrestlers that are going to follow him out of Ohio and into the beautiful state of Tennessee. And we're going to find out how extremely difficult it was to be a wrestler during the Great Depression. I mean, wow, you talk about having a hard time making money. You know, people don't have any money and they can't come to matches. It was a really, really bad time for everybody, no matter what job you had. And Roy, this was going to be the time frame he was going to build his business. And during this tough time frame, then we'll talk about the Southeastern Gulf Coast Territory, which is on fire at this point. And it's going to be paid a visit by another legendary world champion. And this time it's a woman. And I mean a woman as tough as any man, the fabulous Moolah.
I knew it.
Coming to defend her title.
Wow. Okay.
I love watching Moolah. My gosh, man, I used to feel so sorry for those girls. Wow. Moolah was a bad son of a gun, man. So Moolah's coming for her first trip to Southeastern Gulf Coast next studcast. And Robert and I, we had to go back to the drawing board and sit down and figure out, man, maybe what we ought to think twice about this decision to pick our own opponents, man, after what happened to us in Mobile.
Wow. Awesome. Okay. All right, folks, you know the deal on Facebook. You find Ron at Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud. Like and follow in there. Automatically become friends with a living legend. Twitter or X, he's Ron Fuller Welch. You can follow him there, too. Check out the fantastic website, tnstud.com. tnstud.com. This studcast is going to be there with every studcast ever done. Shop the stud store where you can get 43 super stud casts, four different 8x10 photos, the thrilling Lion novel Brutus, personally autographed to you, and t-shirts still on sale, only $15.99, everything with free shipping. Subscribe now at YouTube Southeastern Rewind. Get the best in old school wrestling. Find 408 videos, the last 119 stud casts, 52 stud stories, 108 short rides with the stud, and now 15 Ask the Stud question and answer shows. All this exclusively on YouTube Southeastern Rewind. It is the best deal in old school wrestling. Hey, sorry, but Ron will not be doing a stud cast next week. Look for number 343. Set your calendar for Wednesday, April 3rd. And the cool thing is, if you set the note, if you ring the bell for notifications, we'll let you know and you'll have a definite reminder when the show is back Wednesday, April 3rd. All right. Any final comments today, Ron?
Well, one last reminder to the fans down there in the old Southeastern and Continental Territories, man, I'm going to be in Ozark, the Civic Center, Saturday night, this coming Saturday, March the 23rd, from 6 o'clock. I'll be there probably till the matches are over. And we've got the big special event. You can say hello to Wendell Cooley and also Scott Armstrong, a couple of other wrestlers from back in the day, going to be at this event. And I'll have photos and T-shirts and Brutus. And I'll be taking photos with fans. So I hope to see you there. And I want to thank everybody, man, for your continued support. Please take care of yourself and others. May God bless us all.
For Ron Fuller in the Great Smoky Mountains, I'm David Summers saying thank you for listening. Find me at davidsummersproductions@gmail.com. This studcast is a David Summers production for Tennessee Stud, LLC.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic studcast. The true story continues next week. So fool Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
One, two, three.
This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains.